From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moscowane, sitting in for Terry Gross. On today's Fresh Air, the haunting melodies and harmonies of the McGarrigle sisters. We go back into the archives for a concert and interview with singer-songwriters Kate and Anna McGarrigle. The concert includes an old song written by Anna, made famous by Linda Ronstadt, and a new song they haven't yet recorded. The McGarrigles' first two albums, recorded in the mid-70s, have been reissued on CD. The two are also performing at the Philadelphia Folk Festival this weekend. And commentator Maureen Carrigan reviews a new book and a new exhibit about work. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Frank Stacio. Defense Secretary Les Aspin said today that American troops would stay in Somalia until security is restored in South Mogadishu. He said the U.S. quick reaction forces could be pulled out when progress is made in disarming warlords, and there are police in the main cities. Aspin set out the objectives as the elite Delta counterterrorism team moved into Somalia, along with 400 troops, which are reported to be prepared to search out and capture warlord Mohammed Farah Adid. In Los Angeles today, the Justice Department said it would appeal 2.5-year prison sentences given to two Los Angeles police officers in the Rodney King case. Sergeant Stacy Kuhn and Officer Lawrence Powell were convicted in April of violating King's civil rights during a 1991 videotape beating. We get more from NPR's Ina Jaffe.
The 2.5-year sentences given to Lawrence Powell and Stacy Kuhn have been widely criticized as too lenient. The two officers could have been sent to prison for up to 10 years, and federal sentencing guidelines indicated that they should receive sentences of 6 to 7 years. But in handing down the lighter sentences earlier this month, Judge John Davies argued that Rodney King was responsible for his own beating because he resisted the commands of the police officers and that only the last few blows were in violation of the law. The judge also found that the two defendants posed no threat to society and were good family men. The federal prosecutors were also criticized by the judge for even pursuing this case after all four officers involved in the King incident were acquitted last year in state court. Those verdicts touched off the worst urban rioting in the United States this century. Lawrence Powell and Stacy Kuhn have been ordered to surrender to federal prison officials on September 27th. I'm Ina Jaffe in Los Angeles.
In the West African nation of Togo, President Ayadema appears headed for re-election in this week's presidential election that were boycotted by the opposition, NPR's Suni Khaled reports.
Togolese opposition leaders charged today that the country's military government was continuing a reign of bloody repression after the deaths of 15 young protesters in police custody. The dead were among 40 protesters who were arrested in the village of Abandi, about 150 miles north of Togo's capital, Lomé. Police said the protesters had rampaged through four ballot stations in a bid to prevent voting there. A government spokesman claimed the protesters had been poisoned by friends to discredit the government of Togo's longtime military ruler, Ayadema. Earlier this week, foreign election observers from Germany and the United States pulled out of Togo following the withdrawal of the last two major opposition presidential candidates. The opposition charged that Ayadema had rigged the elections, but calls to delay the elections to probe the allegations were ignored. I'm Suni Khaled in Washington.
Stock prices were lower today on Wall Street. The Dow Jones Industrial Average lost 7.5 points to close at 3640.63. Declines led advances 9-8. This is NPR News. In a Detroit courtroom, prosecutors played a videotape of Dr. Jack Kevorkian admitting that he helped a 30-year-old man commit suicide in violation of a Michigan law. Don Gagne reports.
Kevorkian is charged under a law making it a felony to help someone take their own life. At today's preliminary hearing, the prosecution played an excerpt from a news conference Kevorkian conducted on August 5th, the day after Thomas Hyde committed suicide by breathing in carbon monoxide. Here's Kevorkian on the videotape.
I supplied the gas. I supplied the tubing and the masks and all necessary equipment.
Kevorkian's attorney, Jeffrey Feiger, countered with a videotape of his own showing Mr. Hyde barely able to speak or lift his arms, saying the decision to die was his alone. Feiger says the Michigan law is unconstitutional. The judge is expected to decide in September if a trial should be held. For National Public Radio, this is Don Gagne in Detroit.
The massacre of more than 70 Yanomami Indians in Brazil brought an expression of sorrow from the United Nations today. UN Secretary General Boutros Boutros-Ghali said he is confident that the Brazilian authorities will ensure that justice will be served. Gold miners are believed responsible for the massacre along Brazil's Amazon border with Venezuela. The attack followed a police raid on a clandestine mining camp in an effort to clear the miners from the Yanomami homeland. Company and union officials say Chrysler Corporation wants to offer lower wages and benefits to new hires. UAW Vice President Stan Marshall said the new contract offer is far from acceptable, but added he still plans to recommend the UAW choose Chrysler as its strike target on Monday. French authorities today reportedly began searching a Sudanese ship in Somalia. They are suspicious that it may be carrying weapons to Somali warlord Mohamed Farah Adid. The French are acting on a request from the U.S. government. The ship has been in Djibouti since Tuesday. On Wall Street, the Dow lost 7.5 points to close at 3640. This is NPR in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moscoane. On Fridays this summer, we're featuring some of our favorite material from our archives, like this concert with Kate and Anna McGarrigle, who were Terry's guests this past June.
Today we have a concert and interview with Kate and Anna McGarrigle. Critic John Rockwell once described their music as delicate and subtle, so vulnerable and private that you sometimes want to turn your head away. He said it's the natural honesty in both their music and image that allows the sentiment in their love songs to ring so true. Both Kate and Anna write songs, sing, and play piano, guitar, and accordion. The McGarrigles grew up in Quebec. They record infrequently, which is just one reason why their fans will be very happy to hear that their first two albums from the mid-70s have just been reissued on CD by Ryko Disc. The McGarrigles first became known through songs recorded by Linda Ronstadt and Maria Muldaur. The song the McGarrigles are about to perform was the first song Anna wrote, and became the title track on a popular Linda Ronstadt album.
Heart Like a Wheel.
It's a beautiful song and beautifully sung. Thank you both for doing it, Kate and Anna McGarrigle. Now, the song that you just did, Heart Like a Wheel, I think, Anna, that was the first song that you wrote?
Yeah.
It doesn't seem possible to me, you know, to start off with something that good.
Well, it's sort of an awkward little song, but anyway,
why are you calling it awkward?
Oh, because it sort of moves. It changes metaphors in the first verse, you know, and it's just, I think it was just kind of written off the top of my head, and I didn't think about what I was doing.
Why did you decide to write a song?
I don't know. Just felt like it.
1969, everybody was writing songs.
Yeah, I think it was that.
Instead of poems, everybody was writing songs.
Yeah, I think it was something like that.
And that's one of the songs that helped establish you commercially, I think, because Linda Ronstadt recorded it. How soon after you wrote it?
I think she recorded it in 1973,
maybe?
Either 74, 75, I'm not absolutely sure.
How did she hear it?
Well, Kate had sung it.
We're not sure if she heard it, actually. We never asked her. We should, actually. I used to sing with, when Anna first wrote the song, I was working with another girl called Roma Baron, and we were kind of hanging around the village in New York, and we had taken the song, we worked it up, and we would always finish our set with it, and someone got interested, someone in a group called McKendry Spring, which was around New York at the time, and I think they had the same either agent or manager that Linda Ronstadt had. But at another time in that same year, because we had only worked together for a year, we opened for Jerry Jeff Walker at the Gaslight in New York, and he said, oh, what a lovely song. Could you give me a tape of that? I'll be working with Linda Ronstadt, and I think she should hear it. And we gave him a tape. So I'm not sure which one, but I suppose either one of those two.
There's another singer that helped establish your reputations, you know, as songwriters, and that's Maria Muldaur,
who recorded
some of your songs.
Yes.
And one of those songs was one of your songs, Kate, Mendocino.
No, she didn't.
She didn't record Mendocino?
No.
I thought she did.
The work song. Was
Linda Ronstadt recorded Mendocino later on, but the work song.
Play a few bars of that, the work song.
Right before my blues are blue and the good old songs were new, songs that may no longer please us. But the darkies up, oh Jesus. That one.
So what was it like for you to have other people doing your songs? This was before you had started recording your songs.
Right. It was great. It was truly terrific. To have something that you've written come out. I remember Maria Muldaur did this song on the Johnny Carson show, and she said, I'd like to thank my friend Kate McGarrigle for writing something like that. And I was just
thrilled.
So how did you start performing your own songs after other people started doing them?
On Maria's second record, there was a song. She, at this point, what she did, or what her producers did, they said, well, the first record worked so well, let's get some more songs from the same writers. So there was David Nickturn and myself and a bunch of other people. And so I gave her a tape, and she learned this song called Cool River, and they flew me out. And I wasn't sure what song they were doing. They said, come out and play the piano. And I got to the studio, and they were in the session with about six, you know, heavy-duty musicians. And they said, play the piano, please. And I said, I don't know the song. And they said, well, I thought you wrote it. You gave us a tape. I said, no, that's my sister Anna. And they didn't really know about Anna. And they said, well, where is she? I said, in Montreal. And they actually said, do you think she'd come out here if we called her up? And I called you, right?
I was only too happy to take an airplane. I think I brought my accordion out with me.
And so she came out, and at that point, we had already changed the arrangement. But since we were both there, we sang backup on her version. And that came out on her second record, Waitress in a Donut Shop. And then Greg Prestipino, who was working, helping her get songs, said, can I bring the girls into the studio since they're both out here? And that all happened in a week. And literally, we went in, put down maybe six or seven songs that we had written, not really knowing each other's songs that much, but, you know, Anna would have the lyric sheets to my song. She would sing harmony. I'd sing harmony to her songs. That's why we all ended up singing our own songs at the piano.
So until the Maria Muldaur backup vocals, you weren't really performing together?
No.
We only started performing together when Warner Brothers asked us to sign a contract. And then we realized we had to get some kind of act together.
Which was about a month after we did that demo tape.
Mm-hmm. And we did, you know, we did a couple of little folk festivals, and then we actually got a band together when we finished our first record. And neither one of us had ever worked in the context of a band with a drummer.
But I have to say, Anne and I did work together as teenagers in a group that we were folk singers, like the Weavers.
Uh-huh.
But we were like the backup, you know, there was a tenor, a bass, and the two of us. And we'd get to sing one song in the set. And we had three songs that I think we rotated for 10 years.
Kate and Anna McGarrigle are my guests. More of our concert after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guests are Kate and Anna McGarrigle, and their first two records have just been reissued on compact disc by Ryko Disc. Let me skip ahead a little bit, and let's hear a more recent song than the song we opened with. And Kate, this is one of your songs. It's called I Eat Dinner. Do you want to say anything about writing it, Kate, before we hear it?
Everybody thinks the song's about me, but it's actually about Frida Kahlo. I know Anna says she'll like,
the painter?
Yeah.
The painter?
Yeah, there's an excerpt in the biography of her by Hayden Herrera, saying where she's between husbands and lovers, or somebody's left her, or at this point two people have left her, and she writes a letter to a friend saying, for the first time in my life, I'm having dinner by myself at the kitchen table without any candles on it. I mean, it was the vision, because this woman had her life full.
So Kate said, let me see now. I haven't got anybody in my life right now. I have a very pokey little kitchen with a little round table. And I just happen to have a daughter. But it was, I think, Kate says it's not really about her, but I think it is.
I don't eat leftovers.
That's true.
Why don't we hear the song?
Never thought that I'd end up this way.
When the hunger's gone.
when the hunger is gone.
It's Kate and Anna McGarrigle. What a wonderful song. And I guess maybe, Kate, it's a little bit about you and a little bit about Frida Kahlo.
Well, yes, I suppose so.
I want to get back to where we were before, that you hadn't started performing together till after you recorded backup vocals for Maria Muldaur. I imagine as kids you sang and performed, or at least in the house together?
Yeah, we actually, our father thought it very important that we know how to sing and play. I don't know why, but our parents played at parties for people. I mean, like, they weren't professional musicians, but my mother had a very lovely singing voice, and he would always accompany her, and they'd sing, party songs, kind of. And he was very, very musical. Our father was very musical. And he would teach us songs, and which we thought were dreadfully boring at the time, but he'd actually say, I'll give you a nickel if you learn this song, or something like that. He found it very important to teach us what he knew, the songs that he knew.
What kind of songs did you think of as boring that he taught you?
Oh, the stuff that he liked really was stuff that was pre... So my father was born in 1899, he was in the First War. So in a way, there was a whole period in there of kind of sentimental ballads of people going away and a lot of them not coming back. I mean, my mother remembering her mother crying because her brother was killed at Passchendaele, and that kind of... And there were many songs that we heard later, like an old John McCormick records and stuff, but mostly American songs that had to do with people going away, I guess because of that war. That was the first kind of war, which included Stephen Foster songs and that kind of stuff.
Do you think that's responsible at all for the melancholy strain in so many of your songs?
Absolutely. We were explaining last night, we sang a song, I should say in the context of the tour that we're on, a song called Gentle Annie by Stephen Foster, and I sort of said this was the first song I remember my father playing or hearing, and of course he taught it to us, and Kate sort of jokingly said other people had songs, sort of happy sort of children's songs, and I said we always had songs about death. But I mean, we were an incredibly happy family. Nobody is really sad in our family. I think we're all sort of fairly well adjusted. And
there's a new song that you have that's very much in the kind of folk ballad tradition. It even uses a lot of phrases from traditional ballads. I think this would be a good time to ask you to sing it. Which of you wrote it?
I wrote it. Anna wrote it. And I call it Appalachian Dream, and it's about growing up in the Laurentians and dreaming about Appalachia.
No, the Laurentians part of Appalachia?
Well, they're actually not. They're separate. No, I thought Appalachia was the ones on the other side of the St. Lawrence River.
But, the St. Lawrence River is a fault, and if that weren't a fault, they'd be...
I guess. I always thought of it as Laurentia, so I don't know.
It's because you're Canadian.
And when did you write this?
In the last month and a half.
And let's hear it. This is a song by Anna McGarrigle. Anna is on guitar and vocals, and Kate is on vocals and banjo.
Yes, I must also want to say that it's kind of all a tribute to some people who were in our lives, not who we didn't really know necessarily or know well, but like there's Pete Seeger, who's kind of like the Bells of Rimney, and Johnny Carignan, who was a fiddler who plays the Hangman's Reel, and various people like that we knew as when we were teenagers, that loomed very large in our lives with the songs they sang and the music they played.
Let's hear it. This is Appalachian Dream.
Rested on a ridge.
frail my heart apart and play me little shady grove. Ring the bells of Rimney till they ring inside my head forever. Bounce the bow, rock the gallows for the hangman's reel. And wake the devil from his dream.
Kate and Anna McGarrigle performing in our studio. That's Appalachian Dream, a song written by Anna. There's so many folk songs that are alluded to in that. Did you go through a period when you were starting to perform of doing traditional folk ballads?
Well, when we started singing, we kind of... we sang all the time at home, and when we were 10 or 11, we'd try and learn some Everly Brothers songs and stuff like that. And then... But the age of 13 or 14, I think we heard Joan Baez or something like that. And we started hearing some folk music. Then we met these people very quickly. I think I was about 15 and I was about 16. And these guys were already in their mid-20s, almost 30. And they just had access to incredible stuff. They'd say, why do you want to do a song the song that Joan Baez says? Go to the source where she got it. And so they had us at the Record Center taking stuff from the Library of Congress and collections of stuff by Sam Charters and stuff done, just real field recordings. And they just put us right back into the original places.
Kate and Anna McGarrigle. The McGarrigles' first two albums, Kate and Anna McGarrigle and Dancer with Bruised Knees, have been reissued on Rykodisc. I'm Marty Moscowane, and this is Fresh Air. The McGarrigles will be back with us in the second part of the show.
Love, love, where can you be? Are you out there looking for me? Love, love, where can you be? Love, I am waiting. Heartbeats accelerating.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Marty Moscowane with Fresh Air. Coming up, more of our interview and concert with Kate and Anna McGarrigle. They'll perform one of their French songs from the mid-70s and a song from their latest album. And commentator Maureen Corrigan reflects on the satisfactions of a job well done. She reviews a new book and a new museum exhibit about work. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. Secretary of Defense Les Aspin says that U.S. troops will remain in Somalia until security is restored there, heavy weapons are out of the hands of factional leaders, and a national police force has been established. NPR's Martha Raddatz has more on the story.
The secretary says that he has been given clear direction from President Clinton to stay the course with other nations to help Somalia provide for its people. This, he said, is what the New World asks of American leadership and American partnership. In order to complete the mission in the African country, the chief concern, Aspin says, is security in South Mogadishu.
The overall effect must be so that no group of armed Somalis should be able to take over the country by force or to impose their political will and loot the markets.
Once these goals are achieved, said Aspin, the over 1,700 U.S. combat troops and nearly 3,000 support troops can come home. He did not say how long the mission would take, but did imply that the U.S. would not need to send additional troops to accomplish the objectives. I'm Martha Raddatz in Washington.
Weather forecasters have now upgraded Tropical Storm Emily to a hurricane. The hurricane now has sustained winds of 75 miles an hour, and officials say it most likely will grow stronger. Forecasters are advising residents of South Florida up the coast to North Carolina to keep watch on the storm. The hurricane is now some 400 miles south of Bermuda and about 900 miles off the southeastern U.S. coast. It's moving west at about 9 miles an hour. Weather forecasters say it's possible the hurricane could hit the southeastern coast in 3 to 5 days. The State Department has strongly denounced the government of Iraqi leader Saddam Hussein for continuing a campaign of destruction and repression against Shiite villages in southern Iraq. NPR's Ted Clark reports.
In a written statement, the department said, "We have verified extensive draining and burning of the marshes in southern Iraq, the burning of villages, and ongoing artillery attacks on civilian centers." The State Department said the government of Iraq is trying to deprive innocent civilians of their principal source of food and shelter, and is trying to eradicate a culture which has been present in the marshes for thousands of years. In addition, the statement said the Iraqi government is trying to eliminate a fragile ecosystem unique in the region. Saddam Hussein has kept up military pressure on the Shiites of southern Iraq ever since they rebelled against him right after the Gulf War. U.S. and allied airplanes enforce a no-fly zone in the region to provide some protection for the Shiites there. This is Ted Clark in Washington.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved down 7.5 points to close at 3,640.63 in active trading. This is NPR News. The government has announced it's appealing the 2.5-year prison sentences given to former police officers in the Rodney King case. The appeal filed in Los Angeles by the U.S. Attorney's Office will be heard by the 9th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals. The two could have been sentenced to up to 10 years in prison in connection with the beating of King and fined up to $250,000. Government investigators in Thailand have concluded that the crash 2 years ago of a Boeing 767 was caused by part of the plane's braking system coming on in flight. Paula Whistle of member station KPLU reports.
The May 1991 Lauda air crash in Thailand killed 223 people. The just-issued report concludes that the cause was a faulty thrust reverser system. According to the report, a thrust reverser, something used to slow a plane down once it reaches the ground, kicked in while the jet was still in the air. Boeing company officials say they agree with the findings. In fact, says spokesman Christopher Valiers, the company is in the process of putting better locking thrust reversers on all its 767s.
We're confident that this problem will not happen again when we finish our modification of the fleet. In the interim, there are inspections in place to make sure that the thrust reverser systems are working appropriately.
The company is also putting new thrust reversers on its fleet of 757s and 737s. For National Public Radio, I'm Paula Wissel in Seattle.
President Clinton said that he's had such a good time on his first vacation in 4 years that he would like to extend it for a week. Mr. Clinton told reporters this morning that he wishes that he had another week to stay on Martha's Vineyard, that he's a little spoiled now. As for the possibility of looking for property off the island off the coast of Massachusetts, Mr. Clinton said that he has not looked at the possibility of buying a vacation home near there, and he does not know if he could afford it, adding, "It's a very beautiful place." This is National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Terry is back with the second part of our concert with Kate and Anna McGarrigle, recorded in June. The McGarrigle sisters have been recording since the 70s. Their first two albums, Kate and Anna McGarrigle and Dancer with Bruised Knees, have now been reissued.
You know, in talking about some of the influences on your music, you grew up, I think, in French-speaking part of Montreal?
Yeah. Well, we grew up in the Laurentians, about 40 miles north of there, and we went to French schools in a town called Saint-Sauveur-des-Monts.
Well, you've written some French songs. I should ask you to do one now.
Okay.
There's a song called, pardon my pronunciation.
Go for it.
Complaint Saint Catherine.
Pour Saint Catherine, yeah. Complaint for Saint Catherine.
Anna, you wrote that song?
I wrote it with a friend. I wrote the music, and our friend Philippe Tatarchev wrote the lyrics.
Before you perform an excerpt of that song for us, tell us what it's about for those of us who don't really understand French.
Okay. It's a song that reflects the ambitions or the lack of ambition of the common man who just wants to sit back, not get involved in politics, watch television, his hockey game on Saturday night, and his beer, very important. He won't spend money to go and, get a motel in Laurentians. He'd rather, just stay in his little flat. And that's basically it. I mean, it was written quickly and for fun.
And which instruments are each of you going to play for this?
Okay, Kate will be playing the accordion and singing, and I'll be playing the piano. Okay.
And singing.
Right, and singing.
Moi, je me promène sous Sainte-Catherine. Je profite de la chaleur du métro. Politique fait une guerre contre les moustiques. Je ne me sens pas intrépide quand il fait frais, je fais pas du ski. J'ai pas de motel à Laurentide. Le samedi, c'est le soir du hockey. Y'a l'entente qu'on fait la politique. Le dimanche, on promène son chien.
That's Kate and Anna McGarrigle performing in our studios. And I should mention that the first two McGarrigle Sisters records have recently been reissued by Ryko Disc. I saw you years ago, back in the late 70s, in Quebec, and you performed a concert there. You spoke mostly in French. You did a lot of French songs. Are you political about French in the way that a lot of people in Montreal have become very political about not allowing English?
Boy, you can get into hot water by saying anything, I'll tell you that.
Right.
I think
We're traveling right now with two francophones in our band, and there's something, there's a humor that they have that's just, that doesn't really, we're having just the best time. In some ways I kind of find, but I mean, there is always English moving in on anything, whether it be a Spanish community or Italian community, anything at all, it's there, you know. Mm-hmm. And to lose that would really hurt, but in some ways it does create a kind of a, creates a little tension, unfortunately.
My guests are Kate and Anna McGarrigle. They'll perform another song after we take a short break. This is Fresh Air. With Kate and Anna McGarrigle.
Some of your songs seem pretty personal. And Kate, let me ask you this. You were married to Loudon Wainwright for a while.
That's right. Yeah.
And he's the father of your daughter.
And my son.
And your son. Mm-hmm. And he writes very personal songs too. And some of those songs seem to be about you.
The earlier, nastier ones, to be honest.
Right. How do you feel about that?
I just got asked this recently. Well, you know, I kind of have trouble sometimes separating Loudon the person from Loudon the songwriter.
Uh-huh.
I mean, he's a brilliant songwriter, especially when he's writing nasty songs about people. I mean, that's really where he's at his best. So he's really turned out some very good, nasty songs about me. And sometimes I think I just had to pull way back, you know. I mean, I guess. But now I see that he kind of writes songs about my kids. And, I don't know. I mean, I think Loudon just likes or has to write songs about people who are, you know, who are around him.
Did you ever try to write a nasty song about him?
I don't have that kind of heart. No, wit.
I think Kate makes herself more sort of like the victim rather than she doesn't go after the person so much. So it's kind of sweeter what comes out.
Now Rufus, our son, is writing songs about both of us.
Wait, who is?
My son Rufus. He's 19.
Oh, and he's really?
Right. Yeah, so just there you go.
Final tradition of songwriters.
How do you work out the harmonies when you're working up a song?
I guess it depends on the song. I was going to say, I would say less and less, we seem to concentrate less and less on harmonies now, let's say when we're in the studio, because of our last thing with Heartbeats Accelerating, where we had a producer who really, he wanted to get a certain sound, and I don't think he wanted big block harmonies. That wasn't what he was into. But we've done all that stuff before, like on
Kitty Come Home
on our second record. You know,
we just
layered and layered stuff.
And 18 tracks.
And I guess in those days, I think, no, we were trying to get a desired effect. It was odd sounding. To me, it sounded like something like some kind of ghastly little creatures sort of flying around at some point, you know, like because of some of the harmonies. But there's a definite way where the way we don't want to have them sound, and I can't, when they're just too blocky
right.
sounding. When you have, what note is it on the bottom that we don't want normally?
The third.
You
don't want the third on the bottom. I think also it's nicer to have wider spaces between them as opposed to when everything's just very closed up together. Well, also depending whether you're singing from your high range or your low range, and what you sing on stage is not what you put on record. What you put on record, you really, because you have more control in a studio, you can have effects going where you just cut words off and they put more echo on it and they, you know, they can change it more. But on stage, you have to really just kind of be straight ahead and be musical that way.
It's been a few years, two, 3 years since your last record?
About 2.5 years.
Came out in 1990.
Would you want to be putting out records more frequently than that? Or, I mean, is that by choice or by... not Joyce.
That was a very difficult record. Well, no, we could have had one earlier. I mean, after we made that record, Pierre Marchand, our producer, really extracted so much out of us in some ways that we were just exhausted because he wanted every idea that we had, but we never got to play them. We only got to, what he would do is we'd record, we'd play the song in the studio for the fun of it. Then he'd record everything. Then he'd take little ideas that we had, put them up in a computer and onto a keyboard and sample them. And then he'd reconstruct the song using all those ideas. Then after he had that done, we would have to go back and play it exactly where he had put our ideas. So the whole thing was like building, it was like building a house. At no point did you ever really sit down and play. So Anne and I were just so drained.
It was so different from the way we're used to working. Where we're running the show and we weren't doing it that so much. But I could also understand why he was doing it that way. He was trying to make us sound different from the way we had sounded before.
Would you like to sound that way again? Did you like that kind of architectural approach?
An
almost
a
tour approach to doing it, where somebody works it all out and then you have to... Mm-hmm.
Yeah, some of the
songs worked it out
good.
With our ideas. That was the odd thing. Like, they weren't very much his ideas. He was looking for the stuff that we had, little riffs here and there, you know.
Uh-huh.
And some of it's nice, but not... It's exhausting, and it's not very rewarding, like, when you're in the... It's not rewarding when you never kind of get a buzz of, you know, God, that was a great take, or boy, everybody played well, you know. You just never have that.
So you live about 90 minutes away from each other. Is it good to have that distance so that you're not with each other all the time?
I don't think it would make any difference. I mean, I think we probably, you know, when Anna comes to town, it's a great joy for me. Instead of rehearsing, we go shopping.
Yeah, the thing is, it's funny. I think as you get older and you have families of your own, that you just don't, you don't have time sometimes for your old friends. And I miss that, you know, but I also know that Kate's my best friend and I hope I'm her best friend.
You're my only friend.
Yeah, right. Kate's so mean and nasty.
I'm awful. All those things Loud and said about me were right.
But we're very, very, very close.
And I have great bread stores on my street. Within one block, I have four they make beautiful French bread. So when Anna comes to town, she lives in this kind of
all I can get is sliced bread.
So, because Anna lives in the country, so she can only get city food. But you know, when you live in the city, you get beautiful stuff.
Country food.
Let me ask you to close with another song, and this is a song from your most recent album, right. From
Heartbeats.
Yeah,
Accelerating.
Heartbeats Accelerating. And the song is Love Is. Before you perform it for us, this is a song that was written by both of you and
our sister,
your other
Jane.
Sister Jane. Mm-hmm. How did you collaborate on it?
Anna and Janie wrote this. I actually wrote one line.
She wrote the best line.
And wasn't it generous of them to give you credit?
Very generous. I thank them very much. I really do.
Anna, anything about how the song is written?
No, one day I went to Jane's house. I said, let's write a song. I started writing it, and then when she got off the telephone, she contributed
she's our manager.
A chord change, and then she went back, and I just continued. So it was a collaboration.
And who's playing what on this?
Kate is playing the nylon string guitar. And
singing backup?
That's right, singing backup. And I'm playing the piano and singing.
Lead.
Front up.
Okay. Well, before we hear Love Is, let me thank you both a lot for doing the concert. Thanks so much for being here.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very, very much.
My guests have been Kate and Anna McGarrigle, and their first two recordings have just been reissued by Ryko Disc. And here they are to perform one last song for us.
A shiny car. Love is a steel guitar. Love is a battle scar. Love is the morning star. Love is a 12-bar blues. Love is your blue suede shoes. Love is a hard abuse. Love is a mind confused. Love is the pleasures untold.
Kate and Anna McGarrigle performing in our studio. This weekend, the McGarrigles will be performing at the 32nd Annual Philadelphia Folk Festival. This is Fresh Air.
I'm Linda Wertheimer. Later today on All Things Considered, Secretary of Defense Les Aspin speaking on the United States policy in Somalia. A reporter who is on the scene in Mostar tells a bizarre story of a British woman who broke through the lines with an ambulance to take children out of the city. Phyllis Crockett is at the teach-in, which is taking place on the Mall in anticipation of the 30th anniversary of the March on Washington, which is tomorrow. And we will hear from a feminist group of Finnish ladies, a singing group called Vartina. That's later today on All Things Considered from National Public Radio.
With the summer season waning and Labor Day approaching, critic Maureen Corrigan has a review of a new book and a museum exhibition on the summer's most unpopular topic, work.
The 90s are shaping up as the decade where we're all supposed to heed the advice of my philosopher dentist. As he's revving up his drill, Dr. Rosenbaum always tells me to just kick back and relax. Yoga is hot again, so's gardening. But while trendsetters are practicing deep breathing, poet and critic Donald Hall is still preaching the value of disciplined huffing and puffing. Hall's new autobiographical book, Life Work, examines the rewards of a job well done. If this sounds like the world's dullest topic to you, you might think about what that tells you about the work you do. Hall is the first to admit that lots of jobs stink and that his work conditions are just about ideal. In 1975, he moved to the New Hampshire farm that's been in his family for over 100 years. Living there prompts Hall to trace his own happy obsession with work to the examples set by his ancestors and the farmhands they employed. He knows there's plenty of difference between milking cows and milking the imagination. But Hall points out that, like his forebears, he also makes an unpredictable living through a diverse round of demanding chores. Instead of eggs and maple syrup, he produces essays and poems. On occasion, when Hall travels, he talks to other people about what gives their lives meaning. Always, the conversation circles round to work. I especially like what an Indian businessman tells Hall. He says the secret to contentment is absorbedness. Life Work is written in diary form, so it's all the more shocking when halfway through we learn with Hall that he has liver cancer. Work now is even more important to him as a defiance of death. Hall plans to keep writing short stories and poems, but no more books. From here on in, he tells us, there is only one long-term project. Life Work is very moving, but as Hall acknowledges, it gives short shrift to traditional women's work. So if you're in Manhattan this fall, go see the new show at the Cooper Hewitt Museum entitled Mechanical Brides, Women and Machines from Home to Office. It's a funny, provocative exhibit about how the design and marketing of machines like irons and refrigerators have reinforced gender stereotypes. Because I knew there was a section on telephones, I brought my mother along. Throughout the 1940s, my mother worked as a switchboard operator for the Wayne Liquor Company. She had to answer every phone call by saying the company motto, "Hello, Gain with Wayne." My mother still treasures an old article about herself from the company newspaper, where she's profiled as the Gain with Wayne girl. "Look, Mom," I said when we got to the telephone exhibit, "it says here that women operators were valued for their low wages and gentle voices." But my mother was oblivious. She'd spotted what looked like her old switchboard headset. "That was the best job I ever had," she said for the thousandth time. I know why she says that. She mastered a skill, earned more money than ever before, and got recognition. The museum goers next to my mother looked at her funny. But I thought to myself, if Donald Hall were with us, he'd understand the uncomfortable truth that even exploitative work can sometimes have its satisfactions.
Maureen Corrigan teaches at Georgetown University. She reviewed Donald Hall's new book, Life Work, and the Mechanical Brides exhibit at the Cooper Hewitt Museum in New York, which runs through January 2nd. Fresh Air senior producer today is Fred Landrell. Our engineers this week are Joyce Lieberman, Ron Barron, Bob Balls, and Chris Fraley. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shorrock directs the show. Terry Gross will be back on Monday. I'm Marty Moscowane.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Singer-songwriter Jimmy Dale Gilmore is a cross between country, folk, rock and roll, and oriental philosophy. On the next Fresh Air, a concert with Jimmy Dale Gilmore. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.
Just because of the mood I'm in, I know there's more to the weather than the western